hello. Thank you for being with us today. I'm excited for today's episode, but wanted to take a quick moment to talk about prenatal vitamins. As a doula, I encourage my clients to achieve optimal nutrition through food. However, even with the most thoughtfully planned diet, it is nearly impossible to meet the daily requirements through food alone. Ideally, you should start taking a prenatal before you find out you're pregnant, or as soon as you test positive. P.S. If this is you, congrats. Prenatal vitamins help nourish and support your body while helping you grow that cute little human inside. Nutrients like choline and folate in prenatal vitamins support healthy brain and spinal cord development in early stages of pregnancies. Prenatal vitamins are unfortunately not all made the same. My favorite prenatal brand is called Needed. I first discovered them through our Facebook community, actually. They are very supportive of our community and have secured 20% off to all of our mamas with code VBAC20. Go to thisisneeded.com and enter in code VBAC, VBAC20 at checkout for 20% off. Welcome, everybody. We're going to be talking about policies today. Hospital policies, what do they mean? Why are they created? When do we have the right to say no, or do we have the right to say no? Mm. And I have Julie discussing this with me today. Hey.
You know I'm a policy fighter.
Yes. Me too. Me too. I'm feeling, you know, the longer I have gone, in the very beginning, I was not a policy fighter.
A policy fighter.
I really wasn't. I was a go with the flow. Sure. Okay. Let's do it. You know best. That's really how I was.
A lot of people and
are. It's true. And I think a lot of the time is because we don't know what our options are. We just don't know. And so I'm really excited to get into this with you today. And I always love, because we kind of get into this like spicy mood sometimes when we have topics like this that we're very passionate about. So we are going to be talking about policies today. I do have a review of the week. And this is actually a very recent review, which is so fun. We just posted on our social media for Google reviews, specifically looking for Google reviews and podcast reviews. These are so, so, so important for really us, but also for other people to find this platform, right? Mm-hmm. We want people to hear these stories. We want people to feel inspired and get educated and know their rights. And your reviews truly do matter. So if you have not yet, please, please, please do so. You can leave a review on your podcast platform, or you can go over to Google and just type in the VBAC link. Remember, VBAC is V-B-A-C. And then you can type in a review there. So this reviewer is by Savannah. And she says, I started listening to the VBAC link podcast around 16 weeks pregnant and continued throughout my pregnancy. It was so good and encouraging for me as a mama who was preparing for a VBAC. It helped me gain confidence, helped me know what to look for, watch out for in my providers. Hearing other stories were so encouraging and helped me gain so much knowledge. I had my hospital VBAC unmedicated with my 8-pound, 15-ounce baby. You guys, 8-pound, 15-ounce baby. Perfect size baby, let me just say. And I know my knowledge that I gained from this podcast played a huge role in being able to advocate for myself to get my birth outcome. Huge congrats, yay, Savannah, on your beautiful VBAC for your perfect size baby. And I say that because, you guys, let's get rid of the big baby term. Ugh. Let's just title these babies as perfect size. Because an 8-pound, 15-ounce baby for some providers may be categorized as larger or even macrosomic. So it's really important to know that your baby is the perfect size and your pelvis is amazing and you can do it, just like our reviewer, Savannah.
Your pelvis is amazing.
Hi, my name is Megan. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am a VBAC after 2 C-section mama, a wife, doula, and VBAC educator. This podcast was created to hold space for those wanting to know their options for birth after cesarean. It is a space where you will likely find yourself getting better educated, relate to stories like your own, and finding the inspiration to help you have a better birth experience. Although we will be sharing stories related to cesarean and VBAC, this podcast is for anyone and everyone who wants to receive evidence-based information and learn how to avoid unnecessary or undesired cesareans. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. It is not meant to replace advice from any other medical professional.
Seriously, all right, you cutie, look at you. Did you just get a haircut, by the way?
I did yesterday.
Yes, it looks so
It's cute. A little short. We did some color. It's a little smidgy shorter, but then I think I wanted to go, but it can still like go in a low ponytail for birth. Yeah. So
I'm totally digging it.
Thank you.
Should be having fresh hair right now, but my cute hair lady, she bailed on me the morning of our hair appointment. So
oh, no.
Sometimes we have matching nails. We would have had matching hair because I was actually going to, we don't have them today. You guys, we miss each other. I miss you.
Yeah, we need to go to lunch again.
We do. Well, yes, we love shopping, you guys. Let's talk about hospital policy.
Let's do
it. We know that so many people go into not even just birth, but really a lot of things in the medical world, like just going to a doctor's office visit or going to a small procedure or whatever it may be. And these places have policies. And I want to talk about kind of what does it mean? What does a hospital policy mean? What's the definition? And the definition, according to lawinsider.com, says hospital policy means the principles, rules, and guidelines adopted by the hospital, which may be amended, changed, or superseded from time to time.
Ooh, I love that addition. Amended, changed, or superseded.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it can.
And it does.
And it does. It does.
It does.
You guys, let's just start off right now with the fact of a hospital policy or a policy. Okay. A policy in general is not law. It is not law. If you decide to decline a hospital policy,
it is well within your rights.
Well within your rights. And you know, you could get some kickback. You could probably expect. Will. Yeah, you could probably expect it. But that's okay. That's okay. My biggest thing, my biggest advice is if you are receiving or being told that this is a hospital policy and you disagree with the policy, or maybe you agree with the policy for someone else, but for you, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And you say no, and they say, well,
it's hospital policy.
Well, this policy is policy. And if you choose to break it, then you can sign an AMA.
You are so funny. This policy is policy.
That's literally what they say.
It's hospital policy. And you're like, okay, well, I don't agree with that policy. Well, it's hospital policy.
It's policy. Okay, but I'm telling you, I don't like your stupid policy.
I don't like your stupid policy. We are spicy, huh?
Well, really, though, these things. So, okay, I think I maybe shared this a little bit, but I had a client who had a home birth plan, decided to go to the hospital because she had preeclampsia, and this nurse was not giving her baby and kept saying, it's policy, it's policy, it's policy. And I was like, this mom's word trumps your policy. And as a doula, I was getting into some rocky, choppy waters. I could just feel the tension building. It did not feel comfortable at all. And I looked at my client.
I was like, give her a doggone baby.
They could kick me out. They could. You to know they really could kick me out. And she's like, that's okay. Like, I want my baby. So I pushed, I pushed, and we did get her baby, but we had to fight, you guys. We really, really, really had to fight, and it sucks. It really, really sucks. So there is a, it's called pregnancyjusticeus.org. We're gonna have this. I have not actually even gone through all of it. It is, how many pages is this, Julie? It is like a
I
lot
don't
of
know.
pages.
A lot of pages.
65 pages, you guys. 65 pages of birthright information going through a lot.
And that will
And
be linked in the show notes.
yes, it sure will. So if you want to go read through this, I highly encourage it. It is from Birthrights and Birthrights Bar Association, the National
Nice.
Advocates for Pregnant Women. And like I said, it's 65 pages. But what they said in here, I just think is so powerful. It says there is no point, okay, no, there is no point in pregnancy in which people lose their civil and human rights. And yet, all over the world, people often experience mistreatment and violations of their rights during pregnancy and birth and for and postpartum. We see these
You
things.
need to make that a social media post. Like, people need to know this.
Yes. It, down here, even further, it says we also know that doulas and other people providing support to pregnant and birthing people often bear witness to rights violation of clients of loved ones. In recent surveys, 65% of doulas and nurses indicated that they had witnessed providers occasionally or often, in quotes, engage in procedures explicitly against their patients' wishes. This is a serious issue.
It is a serious issue. I feel like it's really frustrating, especially as a birth photographer, where my lines, like as a doula, are very separate. But like, I always kind of doula a little bit at every birth I go to. Not always like, not like hands-on stuff always or whatever. But like, it's hard when you see people getting taken advantage of and they don't know they're being taken advantage of and they don't know that they have options or choices or they don't know that they can decline or request changes. And that's probably the hardest part is just people just don't know. And I have a little story, kind of like a little tangent, but I'm in this a Facebook support group for a medication I'm on. And it really amazes me continuously about how little people know about a medication that they are taking, right? Like a pretty serious medication that they're taking. And how little their doctors inform them of what the medication is and what some of the side effects and issues are and what they can reasonably expect from it. Because some people just have completely unrealistic expectations because they haven't dug into it at all. And the other day, somebody said something like, I've been really tired and fatigued since I started this medication. But I called my doctor and she said, fatigue is not a side effect, a common side effect with this medication. And I'm like, what? Like, it's literally listed like on the manufacturer's website that's a side effect. It's listed on the like insert for the medication. It's talked about all the time in this Facebook group. And it can be caused by a number of things that the medication affects, right? And the fact that her doctor either didn't know or just told her, you know, like, anyways, so it leads me. I promise there's a point to this. It leads me to the fact that your doctor does not know everything about everything, especially like a family doctor. This medication is prescribed by family providers, sometimes endocrinologists, sometimes, right? And it is impossible for them to know everything about everything. Now, like something like obstetrics and gynecology, like those things are more specialized. And so they're more focused. It's a more centralized area of study, but still. Your doctor doesn't know everything about everything, and it is not uncommon for them to not keep up in advancements in the medications and technology and practices as they evolve. It's very, very common for the medical community to be 10 to 15 years behind the current research and evidence. It just is. And there is no like doctors and nurses and all these things, they have to have certain number of contact hours per year to keep up with training and education, but they do not, it is impossible for them to keep up with everything. And so it is okay for you to have different opinions than your provider. It's okay for you to want different things than is hospital policy, and it is perfectly reasonable for you to make those requests and for those requests to be honored, and it is also okay for you to know more about a particular thing than your provider might.
Yep.
Period, exclamation point, shazam.
Well, and we've talked about this with other providers and other, we've heard about it in other stories where people come in and they have stats that their providers haven't even seen.
Yeah.
So they just kind of get stuck in their own way and their quote unquote policies. And there's other things going on outside. And so they just point blank say, no, this is how it is. And you might have more information. And that doesn't mean you're more educated or qualified or whatever to be a doctor. Exactly. Like, that doesn't mean that, oh, I might as well be a doctor because I know this information and you don't. But that means that you may have found information that your provider's not aware of, and it is okay for you to bring that to their attention. In fact, do it. Congratulations for them to find out the information that they may not have known yet so they can do better the next patient.
Well, I want to say, like, there's kind of an attitude with some medical care providers that, like, don't confuse your medical search with my, or your Google search with my medical degree. Like, yes, come on. I really have a big problem when people get like that, because first of all, and I've said this before and I will continue to say it again, we have at our fingertips access to the largest amount of information ever available in humankind ever. At our desktop, we can sit down and you can go and find information and studies related to anything, anything ever. Yes, don't go looking at Joe Blow down the street's opinion about childbirth or whatever. Like, yes, that might be a credible source. It might not be. But, like, you can literally find these same studies, the same research, the same information that these providers have access to in their path to their medical degree. Is it extensive? No. Are you going to have the hands-on experience that they get with doing these procedures and C-sections and things like that? No, you're not. But you still have access to the same information that they have access to. So I have a big problem when providers have this arrogant attitude that they know more. And yes, while they do know more generally, they might not know more when it comes down to specific things that have been updated since they've gotten out of school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like in a lot of ways, we hear these policies and these things come up and you're like, but where? And then they can't show you the policy.
Yeah, or they'd be like, this is 20 times more likely to rupture. Okay, well, where did you see that?
Where did you
send me to that resource? Oh, which is the way we've always done it.
Yes, like I did a one-on-one consult and a provider told someone that they had this astronomical amount of percentage of rupturing. And I was like, wait, what?
Seriously.
No. And I was like, please challenge your provider and ask them for that. Well, she did, and they were unable to give her that. So we can just hear things, and if we just take them, it could be scary and it can impact decisions when maybe that's not true. So I want to also talk about policy for providers. Like, their policy should be that everyone should have informed consent, right? That they have policies too, that not only you have to follow or that they have to follow. You know, it's a whole thing. There's many policies. And your provider really has to explain the risks, the benefits, and alternatives for any medical procedure, intervention, or anything coming your way. But we see it not happening a lot of the times. Like, we just see people doing stuff because it's within their normal routine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's breaking policy, which is so frustrating to me because I'm like, so you can break policy, but the second I don't want intermittent monitoring, I don't want consistent monitoring, I'm breaking a policy.
So what? Sorry.
So let's talk a little bit more about VBAC and policies surrounding VBAC. We know the policies are just there. They've been created during COVID. Holy Hannah. We saw these policies change weekly, you guys.
Daily.
Yeah, seriously. They went in and they were like, this is a new policy. This is our new policy. This is our new policy. And I was like,
it was freaking whiplash.
What? Yes, it was horrible. It was horrible. But they can change a policy just like that. You can say no to a policy just like that. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I digress. Let's go back. Let's talk about what policies often surround VBAC. I know a lot of the times in hospitals all over, midwives cannot see, it's a policy that midwives cannot treat VBAC. Mm-hmm. Or you can't be induced. It's a policy, can't induce VBAC.
Mm-hmm.
Or we talked about this before we started recording. And I just said it just now, it has to be consistent monitoring.
Yeah. Well, can I just do a little bit of a timeout and a rewind for half a second? Like, hospitals are businesses, okay? Like I just want to explain this for everybody, right? Like, hospitals are businesses. I think we know that. Like, you don't need to yep. have that explained. But major, businesses, in order for them to run efficiently and smoothly, they need to have policies, guidelines, best practices, standards of care, procedures, things like that, right? It is a business. It is okay for them to set parameters for which they want their providers and nurses and everybody that's at the hospital to operate under, right? It's okay for them to have those things. It's okay for them to set those, because if you didn't have those, the business would fall apart. Everyone could be doing whatever the heck they want. There would be a lot of disorder, right?
Yes.
And so policies and procedures and these best practices and things like that, they're created in order to keep things aligned and have a nice model of care so that they can be more cost efficient, so that the patients know what to expect, so that the providers have a routine and things like that, right? So,
yeah.
So there's reasons for these things. However, when we like to push back, when we are bothered, and the thing that really is frustrating about these policies is when they are put in place so rigidly that there's no flexibility, and that it takes away a patient's autonomy, and that it removes the individualized care from the birth experience. And so this is why we want to talk about this. This is why we don't think all policies are dumb. No, we don't. We see the reason. We understand why they're in place. However, we want you to know that it's well within your rights as a human to decline and request changes for these policies, and to desire something different, and to have that desire respected. It's hard when some providers and nurses get so stuck in the fact of this is policy that they take away your autonomy and your right to choose. And so that's what we're like pushing back against. And that's what we want you to know, is that these policies are not law, and you have the right to want something different and request something different, and to have that right respected.
Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I do think that it can be really hard, because when they have these things to keep order, mm-hmm. right? To keep things tidy.
And with the intention to keep you safe. Like, that's, I feel
yes.
like, right? But sometimes intentions don't always translate well. But anyways.
Well, yeah. But I also want to just really quickly, before we get back into what policies, you know, surround VBAC, when we start questioning policy, there are things that can come into play where there's like threats, there's coercion, there is like gaslighting that starts happening, because they're really panicked that you're questioning their mm-hmm. policy. They feel very uncertain that you are feeling.
Well, they might even feel unsafe, or they might never have had the policy challenge before, so they don't know what to do about it,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So, yeah, just know that if people are coming at you with, well, if you don't do this, then this, or whatever it may be, then it can get intense, but you can still say no. You can also ask for a copy of that policy. Again, even though that policy isn't law,
well, and ideally, you would do this before labor begins, yes. Because it's really hard to fight with and bump against these policies during labor.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's going to be a lot harder.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's go in. So I talked a little bit about, like, so there's fetal monitoring, you know, not induction. Being seen by certain people, no induction, or the opposite,
which or you have to be induced,
or you have to be induced
by such and such a date.
Yes, it's just so funny because it varies all over. But
it does vary all
let's
over.
Talk about it. Okay, so fetal monitoring.
I'm gonna let's talk. Oh, don't forget epidural placement too.
Yes,
we can talk about that. That's my favorite one to argue against. Anyways,
yes, okay. Guys, there's so many. Okay, let's talk about fetal monitoring. Okay. What is the policy typically behind continuous fetal monitoring?
Yeah, so most hospitals, in fact, I've never met a hospital where this hasn't been the hospital policy, is that continuous fetal monitoring is required for everybody, but especially for VBAC. Like, they double down for VBAC because one of the first signs of uterine rupture, especially when somebody has an epidural, is irregular fetal heart tones. That can be one of the first signs of uterine rupture. And so most hospitals are very, very adamant about having continuous fetal monitoring, especially for people who are undergoing a TOLAC, which is trial of labor after cesarean. It's not a bad word. It's just how it's defined in the medical community before you have your VBAC. And the reason why they do that, like I just said, but honestly, like, if you don't have an epidural and if you're not under any type of pain medication, the first sign of uterine rupture for you is going to be a really intense pain. That's going to be your first sign. And so, especially if you're going unmedicated, I think it's perfectly reasonable to request the intermittent monitoring. And do you want me to go into, like, why they introduced fetal monitoring in the first place? Okay, so in the early 1970s, we saw lots of rapid advancements in the medical field and technology, right, related to the medical field. And things like continuous fetal monitoring got introduced. Antibiotics became more readily accessible. The procedures themselves, especially like the C-section procedure, became perfected and easier to do with fewer complications, fewer rates of infection, like all sorts of things started happening really rapid pace in the early 1970s. And one of the things that got introduced was continuous fetal monitoring.
Taking a quick break to continue our earlier conversation about the importance of the right prenatals for pregnancy and beyond. As I mentioned, my favorite brand is Needed. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally intensive times for a woman's life. You don't have to feel so terribly nauseated or so depleted in the postpartum stage. A prenatal multi that optimally nourishes you can make all the difference between just getting by during and after pregnancy and feeling your very best. Let's not just survive, we definitely need and deserve to thrive. Needed is clinically backed, third-party tested, and formulated the best, in my opinion, prenatal vitamins. They took so much time to learn about women and why we are getting the bare minimum nutrients, and then designed the supplements that addresses women's needs at every stage of pregnancy and beyond. Needed's prenatals are filled with the optimal amount for both you and your baby and include important ingredients such as choline, folate, vitamin D, and more. Enjoy 20% off at thisisneeded.com with code VBAC20. That is thisisneeded.com and use code VBAC20. Back to today's episode.
And the reason why the intention behind the continuous fetal monitoring when it got introduced was to decrease the rates of cerebral palsy in infants. So cerebral palsy usually happens when during either pregnancy or labor, when oxygen is deprived to the brain of the baby, which can cause a stroke and damage part of the white matter in the brain. And the idea behind it was if you could catch the reduced flow of oxygen to the baby by monitoring its heart rate, you could intervene and do a C-section in time to get the baby out before cerebral palsy happens, essentially. And the interesting thing about that is that after continuous fetal monitoring was introduced, there was no change in the rate of cerebral palsy. It stayed the same and it still is very similar. But what it did do is it was one component that increased the rates of C-sections and other interventions. They are more likely to take a baby out due to non-reassuring fetal heart tones. And we've seen no improvement in maternal mortality or morbidity rates and infant mortality rates either with the introduction of all of these interventions.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why they say that it's mandatory for VBAC specifically is because fetal heart tones, decelling, is one of the signs, one of many of the signs that uterine rupture may be taking place.
Right.
And so
right.
They
I said
feel
that.
Right. Oh, you did. I was reading the link. I missed that.
No, you're fine.
Okay.
Say it again. It's okay.
No, you're fine. So with uterine rupture not always being, like fetal heart descents not always being a symptom of uterine rupture, what do you feel like that means? Like, do you feel like, I feel like so many people feel more comfortable having their baby on the monitor so they can hear them.
Oh, they do. And do you know what? The staff is more like that, more likely to do that too. We have, this is really sad, but we have a labor and delivery culture that is very, very comfortable sitting at a desk down a hall, watching a monitor to see how a patient is doing rather than remaining in the room and watching them. Mm-hmm. They rely more on what is going on the contraction monitor and the heart rate monitor than they do the visible signs of the patient. Mm-hmm. It's how they've been trained. It's how they monitor dozens of people at once in a labor and delivery unit. And I feel like continuous fetal monitoring and the contraction monitor is another way that de-individualizes care. I don't know if that's a word. It takes out the individuality. It takes out the rights to the human, and it takes out really watching the person and relies too much on the data. Now, data is good. I love data. Don't get me wrong. I am a data junkie 110%, but data can only take you so far. And so I feel like that's why people freak out about the continuous monitoring thing. It's like, how are we supposed to know if you're doing okay at the desk? Because we can't see the little chart on the screen if we're not monitoring you continuously. And it puts more work on them, which is okay. Like, I just can't imagine being a labor and delivery nurse, because sometimes have more than one patient that you're monitoring and watching, and you've got lots of other things to do, including charting and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But
it's
just one of those things
was created that also, even though the evidence didn't prove that the reason why it was created to like work out, it stayed because it brought ease to labor and monitoring it and monitoring it and not being in the same room and being able to have five other patients while seeing a chart, right? Okay, so fetal monitoring, that's one. Let's talk about the induction or the not induction. Like, that we've seen policies on both ways, which also is so weird to me. I know that it's like hospital to hospital, but why aren't we going off evidence?
Dude. Do you know what is so funny to me? Like, and I will also cry this out from the rooftops until I die, that if you really want to understand what maternal health care is like in the United States, you've got to talk to a doula or a birth photographer, because we see not only hospital births and home births and birth center births, but we see all the different hospitals and how they vary in hospital policy. And it is so funny to me sometimes the conversations I hear or have with labor and delivery nurses who insist one thing, and then the next labor and delivery nurse in the next hospital insists something completely different. Like, oh, it's not safe to go past, you know, 20 for Pitocin on VBAC. And then the next hospital will be like, oh yeah, well, yeah, it's perfectly safe as long as you're monitored and the IOB signs off on it. But like, that's what, up, down, and sideways, because of whatever the specific hospital policy is, right? And it's not their fault.
Yeah.
Which is why sometimes I like travel nurses and some of the labor and delivery nurses, because they just have a completely different, or the labor and delivery units, like the travel nurses go just all around the country and have vastly different experiences with different hospitals. And it's fun to see the culture shift or something that can come in
Yes.
when that happens. But anyways,
They do.
sorry.
No, yeah, no. So in some hospitals, it is policy that you have to go into labor spontaneously.
Yeah, they
And
will not induce for VBAC.
they
Oh,
will
but if you
not.
haven't had your baby by 40 weeks, they're gonna,
So
it's
that's what I was just
hospital
gonna
policy to do a
say.
C-section.
Yeah, so it's like they will not induce you, but then if you go into labor, if you don't go into labor by 40 weeks, they have to schedule a C-section. So what's the evidence there, and why is that even being a policy, right? So a lot of providers after 40 weeks fear, or they say that VBAC uterine rupture chances skyrocket after 40 weeks because, oh, that baby's getting bigger, they're stretching that uterus out, but that's not really necessarily the case. And we're seeing it happen more and more and more, where people are then doubting their body's ability to give birth or go into labor, or they are so scared that their baby's gonna get so big that they're going to cause uterine rupture if they go past 40 weeks. I mean, really, you guys, the amount of things that we see coming in the VBAC Links DMs, I love that you guys write us. Please keep writing us, but it's frustrating, not that you're writing us, but that these providers are telling these people these things, right? And then we have the opposite of like, we have to induce by 40 weeks.
Hey, can I
So,
read you this thing? There's a
yeah.
post in the VBAC Link community today. There's a VBAC, the VBAC agreement form. Like if
Okay.
you're birthing at a hospital, you'll most likely have to sign a piece of paper showing all the risks about VBAC, but they don't ever just make you
They
do that
don't
for a
ever say
C-section,
anything
but
about
whatever.
VP's discern,
But
yeah.
this hospital policy, hold on, let me see. I was reading it this morning. Oh, so listen to this. This is word for word, okay? Word for
Okay.
word from this VBAC agreement form from a hospital. I am aware that the best chance of successful VBAC is to go into spontaneous labor and that the risk of cesarean section is increased past my due date. In an effort to afford me the best chance of achieving VBAC, I agree to be induced the 39th week of pregnancy or sooner if medical issues are present if I am still pregnant. So in that same paragraph, they say the best chance of a successful VBAC is
It's
going into spontaneous
spontaneous.
labor. But if you don't go into labor by 39 weeks, we're going to induce you.
And it also says after 40 weeks, my cesarean chances increase. So we have to induce a whole week before.
Right? Like, how
Sorry.
is this real life? Like, how is this even like a thing? Like, I just blah blah blah. That's what I say. Like, screw your policy. Like, how can you contradict yourself like that? Like, where and it says like the risk of a cesarean section is increased past my due date, but it's also increased if you induce me. So why? So either way, I have an increased risk. This is literally what they're telling you in this in this form that they make you sign.
You know, and that those forms are so important to pay attention to, you guys. As you are getting these forms, they're, VBAC consent forms or VBAC agreement forms or whatever they are. They title them all different. Like,
I'm aware of this. I'm
really.
just reading this hospital policy more. Sorry. I am aware of the hospital policy requiring two IV access sites.
Okay. Today, which was, you guys, last, trying to think of when,
Put you
like a
two
month ago.
Heplocks?
A month ago, I recorded the episode today, but a month ago that this is coming out, you guys go listen to Paige's midwifery episode. She just was talking about that is a policy within their hospital that she helps people at, that they have two Heplocks. This was news to me as of today, and now you're saying this in this policy. Why? Why? What is the evidence behind that? Why?
All of these, like this feedback agreement form is like every single thing that we are talking about. I agree to have continuous fetal monitoring. I am aware of this policy by this obstetrics group. I won't say it because maybe we shouldn't call them out. Maybe we should. To require epidural placement by the time of active labor.
Okay, this is one thing that we wanted to talk about.
I am aware of implications of certain complications of labor can be life-threatening to myself and my baby, and these can only be addressed promptly at the hospital to lessen the risk of delay during a complication. I agree in bold.
Yeah, all the agrees are in bold.
To the hospital immediately if I am in labor or if my water breaks. I have been adequately counseled about the risks, benefits, and alternatives of VBAC. And have opportunity to ask questions. I'm aware that no one's able to guarantee a successful VBAC and that a repeat C-section may be indicated if my baby is breached. I do not adequately dilate. I am able to push my baby out. My baby does not tolerate labor. There is a concern for uterine rupture or any unforeseen medical issue arises during my pregnancy, which makes labor unsafe, according to WHO. Anyways, certain methods of induction of labor are not permitted to be used in patients with prior cesarean sections. I understand that if I'm induced, the only safe options include medical dilation with balloon, Pitocin, and breaking my water. I mean, that I feel like
that is valid. Accurate. That's valid. Okay.
That's the only one. Cool.
Cool. Out of like 10. You guys.
Are you reading this right now?
Yes, like, I pulled it up.
You have up?
Yes. Oh! I pulled it up. So let's talk about epidural. It talks about it. You guys, this has 86 comments already.
She already did not.
Like one of the commenters said, you absolutely do not need to get an epidural. Have continuous monitoring or go into the hospital right away when labor begins. These are often things to avoid when trying for a VBAC. You absolutely can have these things, but get an epidural before you can have these things, but an epidural before 6 centimeters can put you at a higher risk of cesarean, including continuous monitoring. Your rights override policy. This is what she said.
Yes.
She says, are you in the States? Did you sign this?
But I love what Floor Cruz with Badass Mother Birther said. This is atrocious. Run. I'd rather give birth in the woods by myself than to ever agree to this monstrosity.
You guys, really though, we have so many things coming at us. We're so vulnerable when we are pregnant and we want a VBAC so bad. And we have forms like this being given, or we have policies being thrown at us, and we say like, just say no, you know, but when you're in that moment, it's really difficult. And I think something that I want to say is, as you're learning these policies, as you're learning more, figure out if you are someone who can stand up to these policies and say no. Or figure out if there's someone on your team that you need to have be there to help you find the strength to say no. And also make sure that your family knows and your team knows what's important to you when it comes to these policies, what triggers you. Because it is very difficult to say no, or I am not going to do that. Or to not even say a word because they just strap the monitors mm-hmm. on you, or call anesthesia because they just did a cervical exam and the nurse logged that you're 6 centimeters. And so anesthesia is just coming on down, but you might be doing really well and not want an epidural, you know? So, okay. I want to talk about
epidurals. Let's talk about epidurals. Oh,
yes.
Let's do it. Guys. This is like my favorite policy to just tear apart, rip apart. So here's the thing. The reason why they tell you they want an epidural placed, but you don't have to have it turned on. Just place the epidural just in case. If a uterine rupture happens, you can dose up the epidural and go back to surgery and they don't have to put you under general anesthesia. Sounds great, right? Cool. Yeah, let's do that. That sounds great. I don't want to go under general anesthesia if I need to have a C-section. Well, here's the problem with that, okay? First of all, going under general anesthesia does carry more risks than having surgery with a spinal or an epidural. It does, just common knowledge. And nobody's going to argue that here. We get that. But the problem is in a true emergency, okay, like we're talking about like seconds matter, minutes matter, right? If you have a catastrophic uterine rupture, baby's in your abdomen now, that baby has to be out in minutes or less. They are going to do a splash and dash. They're going to throw not lidocaine. What is it? The antiseptic, the orange stuff that sent
iodine?
Iodine. They're going to throw iodine on your belly and they're going to slice you open. Sorry, that was a really not very sensitive way to say that. They're going to just take the baby out as fast as possible, right? once you're in the OR, and they have to knock you out under general anesthesia. There is not enough time to dose an epidural, especially if it's not ever turned on. Okay. Especially, but even if it is turned on, it takes 20 minutes or more to get an epidural dose to surgical strength to where you will not feel the incisions and the surgery that comes with a C-section. 15 to 20 minutes at minimum in order to get you dosed to surgical strength. If you have an epidural and it is urgent where minutes matter, you will have to go under general anesthesia no matter what, period. If a C-section is needed, there is time to give you a spinal, which takes effect in just a few minutes, 3 to 4 minutes. It takes some time to get the anesthesiologist in and get the OR or things like that. But usually, realistically, if it's something that's urgent but not emergent, you can get a baby out in 10 to 15 minutes without already having an epidural placed. So here's the thing. Placing an epidural is preparing you for surgery, period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If there is an emergency, you will have to be put under general anesthesia, period. If a C-section is needed and minutes don't matter, like we need to get this baby out soon, you can get a spinal. Period.
Period.
So screw that epidural hospital policy. It's literally for convenience, so you already have an epidural place so that they can take you back to do a C-section.
Yep. But again, the epidural is infinite. It just doesn't get in fast enough, even if it's placed or not.
Exactly.
Like, I hate it. I hate when it's like, I don't want an epidural, but I'm getting it just in case. Okay. And then going back to this policy that she was just reading, will not labor at home. If my water breaks, I have to come right in. You guys, if you want to labor at home, do your research. Labor understand, always, always. If you are a VBAC, I don't even care if you're planning on an induction, what? Always learn the signs of uterine rupture. Always. It's so important to know. Okay? Even though it happens very little, it happens, and we need to know the signs. Mm-hmm. But it's okay to labor at home. Talk to your provider about that. If they're really like, the second you have a contraction, you have to come in. That is a red flag. You guys, they also start monitoring and pushing induction, even though your labor's been going, they induce your labor more. They get it going further. What if you're having prodromal labor and it's just going and then it stops for, 5 hours and then it, there's so many things. And I'm no provider. I can't say you must labor at home or you should really labor at home, but really look at these things and understand what could happen if you choose to go in the second your water breaks. Let me go tell you what happened to me. My water broke. I went straight in within an hour. I hadn't progressed too much. And so they started Pitocin. They immediately started Pitocin. They kept cranking it up. My body was struggling. I was struggling. My baby had a couple D cells. They called it. Okay. It's really, really frustrating. But you guys, we have so many comments in this here that I could just read all of them because, they say a lot. They say a lot. This is fear-based care. I'm sorry that you're having to go through this. I mean, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard someone said. You guys,
seriously,
when it comes to policy, it's not a law, okay? It's really not a law. Stand up for yourself. Understand the policies around VBAC. When you are looking for your provider, we cannot stress this enough. Ask them about their policies. If their policy is you must get that just in case epidural, you have to have a baby by 39, 40 weeks, or we induce, or we schedule a cesarean. You have to come in the second a contraction starts. If your water breaks, you must come in. You have to come in. They're making people sign these policies like they're law. It feels law.
Like it's a legal document. Like you can't change your mind. And that's what it does. It makes people think they have to agree to things. I signed the document. So here I go.
So here I am. I have a written agreement, right? But they could change. What did it say? What did the definition, what did it say? It says that it can be amended, changed, or superseded. That's like supersede your
Superseded.
Yes.
Yes. But here's the thing too. I'm kind of glad when hospitals do this because it shows you all the red flags. It lines out their red flags. No questions, black and white, red flags laid out for you. And then you know either how to address them before labor or how to hightail it out of there and find another practice. Because nothing is worse than getting blindsided during labor by a policy that you don't agree with and having to advocate to change that in labor. So I would encourage you, if your provider doesn't make you sign this wonky form, then beforehand, before you even start care with them, find out what their hospital policies are about VBAC.
Yes.
Find out so that you can address them ahead of time. Have your provider sign off on changes to policy that you want and put it in your medical record. So if you get a different provider on the day you go into labor, that provider can access your records and see that it has been signed off, approved, or whatever your changes that they are going to make to the policy for you and your specific needs. It is okay to ask for that. It is okay to fight for that. It is necessary to fight for that sometimes. Obviously, it would be ideal for you to find a birth location whose policies align with the things that you want. Sometimes you might want, somebody might want continuous fetal monitoring. And maybe it makes them feel better mentally. Maybe, you know, that's just their preference and that's okay. It's okay to want that. But it's not okay to let a system dictate how you want to birth when you want something different.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also not okay for you to feel cornered or like coerced, or you're like a bad mom because you're making a decision that goes against a policy. You know, I don't like that. I do not like that. It's not okay. And I highly suggest going and checking out the show notes, reading more about your birthrights, what it means, you know, all of it. There's one of, in part of that little birthright document PDF, the 65-page document, it talks about down in the kind of, I don't know, first like 4 or 5 pages, it says what, let's see, it says, I have the right to, and then it has a whole bunch of things. It says to say no and be heard, to have my basic needs be met, to labor in the way that works for me, to birth vaginally, to know all of my options, to change midwives, doctors, and nurse, to not be touched, to ask people to leave, to feed my baby human milk, to leave the hospital or the birth center. You guys, you have rights. You have rights. You are amazing. Use your rights. If you are being, you know, if you're in a corner that feels like they're being taken away, or they're gaslighting you or coercing you or whatever it may be, you have rights. So check this document out. I highly suggest it. Talk to your providers, check out their policies, dissect the policies, dissect them, really break it down. What does that mean? Why is this being put on as a policy, right? In the one policy that Julie just read, it said that they will not induce, that VBAC is not applicable to be induced with certain things other than XYZ. Okay, if you go back down and you look at the research and you learn about that, that's pretty dang valid. That is understandable. Okay, that policy has been put in place for your safety. Okay, but there are others that I would say no. I don't think. They may be thinking that's your safety, but there's no evidence behind that. So dissect them, learn them, really learn how to advocate for yourself, get your team ready, know it's not a law, and love yourself because you deserve more. Okay. Anything else you'd like to ask, Julie?
Nope. I love that. Love yourself. Take ownership. Take ownership of your birth experience. Don't give it to somebody else.
Yes.
Stand up for yourself. Take ownership. I love what you just said. Love yourself. You deserve to have choices in how you are treated during your birth experience.
Absolutely. Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Hello, hello. Thank you for being with us today. I'm excited for today's episode, but wanted to take a quick moment to talk about prenatal vitamins. As a doula, I encourage my clients to achieve optimal nutrition through food. However, even with the most thoughtfully planned diet, it is nearly impossible to meet the daily requirements through food alone. Ideally, you should start taking a prenatal before you find out you're pregnant, or as soon as you test positive. P.S. If this is you, congrats. Prenatal vitamins help nourish and support your body while helping you grow that cute little human inside. Nutrients like choline and folate in prenatal vitamins support healthy brain and spinal cord development in early stages of pregnancies. Prenatal vitamins are unfortunately not all made the same. My favorite prenatal brand is called Needed. I first discovered them through our Facebook community, actually. They are very supportive of our community and have secured 20% off to all of our mamas with code VBAC20. Go to thisisneeded.com and enter in code VBAC, VBAC20 at checkout for 20% off.